Here's what you can look forward to in today's episode.
So a lot of what we're building through Engages are these frameworks that can be used to take all kinds of communications and put those into more of a storytelling type of narrative so that you can take people on a journey. You can pull those emotional levers when necessary in order to communicate a story and in order to try to influence, and move a market in one direction or another.
Over the last decade, the market research industry has been disrupted. Our largest agencies are struggling to keep up as their customers turn to newer, faster, and cheaper data sources. Now, we are on the edge of yet another major market shift. Now is the time for us to reassert ourselves as the rudder of the brands we love. Thank you for tuning in to the Happy Market Research Podcast, where we are charting the path for the future of market researchers and businesses. Hi, I'm Jamie Brazil, and you're listening to the Happy Market Research Podcast. My guest today is David Paul, CEO of Engages and Dial Smith. Engages and Dial Smith is a consultancy that leverages a proprietary technology solution to help companies craft and refine high-stakes messages and content. Additionally, David started the Engages podcast, where he connects with many disciplines like comedy and astrophysics to help create a more complete skill set for us insights professionals. David, thanks very much for being on the Happy Market Research Podcast.
Jamin, thanks so much for having me.
So it's an honor to, I think you may have one of the original podcasts centric to market research, at least from my recollection. Is that consistent with yours?
Yeah, I think we kicked off pretty early when we launched ours in early 2018. I believe the Insights Association was doing their Audible Insights podcast. I believe it started shortly before then, might have been around that time. And certainly apologize to anyone who has been doing it longer, but certainly in the early days of it when we started early 2018.
Well, if people listen to this and have been doing it longer, know of shows that have been doing it longer, we would love to connect with them, both David and myself. So please put them on our radar. We will humbly submit our error and also love to have the conversation and learn from the godfathers in the space.
Absolutely.
So listen, man, I wanted to talk a little bit about your background before we jump into some other topics. So you have a strong background in technology, and then interestingly enough, also sales. And then you founded Dial Smith in 2009. That was an interesting point, right? Economically speaking, the U.S. was, in turmoil still from the Great Recession. What gave you the confidence and the inspiration to step out and start your own company?
That's a good question. It was really a matter of necessity more than anything. So my background is technology and sales. I didn't start out in the market research space, though I've been in it now for going on 20 years. But on the Dial Smith side of our business, our core technology are the perception analyzer dials that everyone in research knows from dial testing of TV pilots, presidential debates, and things like that. And back in the 2000s, we were a division of Market Strategies, a large market research firm. And it was during that time of the recession in 2009 when there were a number of smaller divisions of that company and really of others that didn't really fit within those organizations anymore, especially during that time. So it became an opportunity for us to spin off what's now called Dial Smith as a standalone business. And it actually, the timing worked out really well for us because we were a small company, but as soon as we got out from under a larger corporation, we were able to function in a very healthy, very profitable way as a pretty small business at the time. And we've certainly grown since, but we've had the good fortune of being profitable since the day we started, December 1, 2009. Fully self-funded and all along the way and have grown, organically and bootstrapped all along the way. So all in all, it worked out for us, but it was definitely a bit of a sketchy time.
Yeah, no kidding. And when you think about like some of the challenges centric to operating a division of a much larger organization like you did, you know, for you to be able to step out and then be captain of your ship or master your destiny or whatever you want to say, right? I mean, that had to be remarkably freeing.
It was freeing, and it was, of course, you know, terrifying as well. You've been in the exact same boat of starting and running your own company really from the ground up. Anytime I tell this story, I call it the perfect startup, because Market Strategies was a great place for us to be. And they were also an incredible partner for me when spinning off DialSmith. And they helped me get on my feet and get the business started. But we started DialSmith with a pre-existing customer base, a pre-existing product line, and employees. So, you know, one day we switched off the light and went home. And the next morning we turned on the lights as DialSmith, and it was business as usual. And then we set our path for growth over the years. So we had a really good early footing, and we have a great staff, many of whom are still with us today, and they were with me for, you know, the 10, even 15 years prior. So it all comes down to the people, regardless of the economic climate.
What was the impetus for the spinoff? Was it driven by the executive team, or, you know, were you guys pushing it up? I don't want to say a skunk works, but, you know, were you guys kind of driving that idea up to the executive team?
Yeah, no, it came down from the executive team. It was during the recession, and I think it was really just a function of how they wanted to structure the company going forward. And we were a bit of a Skunk Works division, you know, much smaller, kind of off to the side. And I think strategically for them, it was just the right time to jettison, you know, a business like that. And as you know, from bigger companies, we were a relatively small division operating in a large organization with larger corporate allocation and higher overhead, which made it challenging for us financially as a division. So as soon as we got off on our own and we were able to be structured as a pretty small team with much lower rent, and we weren't carrying, you know, the allocation that goes along with a bigger company, just because that's what bigger companies need to function, we had to pull our weight. As soon as we got out from under that, then you know, the economics of the business instantly started to make sense. I think Market Strategies knew that was going to happen, which is why they encouraged me and supported me through that whole transition.
How was the customer view going through that, right? Moving out of the large and then into the smaller boutique-y at that particular, you know, 2009. Mm-hmm. Was there concern among the customers that you were servicing around overall ability to consistently deliver quality? And then the second part of it is, from a sales and marketing view, you know, how did the market see that?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. We really didn't experience any customer pushback. We were really diligent about the way we explained and positioned what we were doing. And as I mentioned, because we took the product line with us, we acquired all the IP that came with us, and almost all of the staff came along, we were able to very accurately assure our customers that it's business as usual. You're dealing with the same people, and you're getting the same products and the same service. You're getting it under a, you know, a new company name, really, more or less, was the only change to them. So, you know, if anything, we picked up a little bit of positive press around that, but there was no negativity, no pushback. We didn't lose any customers from it. So the whole experience was positive.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. That's like the absolute best. That's like a startup in a box, right?
Yeah, well, and that's the style of entrepreneur I am. I mean, I'm not a major risk taker. I've known since I was a teenager that I wanted to own and run my own business. I remember being a teenager I was younger than a teenager. I was preteen, sitting at the dining room table, and my father, who was also in business his whole career, I remember he had his paper spreadsheet book, his spiral bound paper spreadsheet book, pre-computers, pre-Excel. And he was using a, you know, very sharpened pencil to write all of his numbers into all the cells on his spreadsheet. And that's my first memory of business. And I remember just becoming fascinated with it. And then all through high school and college and everything was all different types of sales for me, sales and marketing. So I've always known that that's the direction I was going to go in, but I'm not a major risk taker. I'm not a, you know, grind it out and hustle kind of guy. I more succumb to, you know, the feeling that businesses can be run in a healthy, productive way where everybody comes to work, does good work, but then also gets to enjoy going home and being with their families and enjoying their free time. So this is the kind of business where we didn't have to start it out under ridiculous pressure. And because we had a good staff and good products and great customers, we were able to just keep steady. And it's really been steady as she goes in the 9 years since we started.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on your success. I love that. Oh, I love that story. I also like I had forgotten this, but you resurrected the memory for me. My grandfather used to trade stocks, right? And so Sunday we'd get the paper, which would have the report on how the stocks were performing. He'd then take that I forget how many stocks he was monitoring, but it was a lot. I would say around 25 to 30 stocks. And he would enter by hand each one of these each one of their prices into a ledger and then graph them, on graph paper. And then after he had an adequate sample size, he would start making decisions on where he wanted to place his bets. It was a completely different, I mean, talk about an analog world compared to how I'm tracking stocks now. It's been a fun transition, but I'll tell you this, there was a connection you had with the data doing it that way that I think in a lot of ways can get overlooked given how easy everything is nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, really, it's funny because I don't have that many memories from back in those days at all, but there's something indelible about that one moment. Walking over to him and sitting down next to him and having never seen that giant spreadsheet before. And I remember him just explaining to me what it is and how he was setting it up. And he had his calculator out doing all the math. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago. But that was all data-based work and how he was, you know, managing the companies that he was running at the time.
So let's shift gears. Let's talk about podcasting. Obviously, I'm highly passionate about this particular subject. How long have you been listening to podcasts?
I've been listening for a pretty long time. I mean, I'd have to say maybe 5 years or so. Got into them as really as something that I could do at the gym, something I could listen to that was just more interesting than the same old music all the time. I fortunately never had to drive a ton, so I don't listen a lot in the car, but you know, I download them for flights and I listen to them at the gym, but it's probably been going on about 5 years or so.
Do you have any podcasts that were like inspirational for you in starting the Ingregious podcast?
Yeah, well, you know, maybe it's a little cliche to say, but what Tim, his name's escaping me, 4-Hour Work Week, Tim.
Oh my gosh, really? Come on. And all I can think of is Tim Allen. All right, hold on.
I know. this will be an edit point. We'll just circle back.
I don't know. It is pretty funny that I can't.
This is so.
Tim Ferriss. How could we not think of that?
I feel so silly, of course. So it may be cliche to say, cause you know, he's clearly one of the largest out there, but, what he's been able to put together between a combination of, long form interviews that he then of course cuts down into shorter form discussions, but then also standalone episodes where he picks a topic and talks about it himself, which we haven't gotten into much on our podcast yet, but that's also interested me. I just want to be sure that I'm covering topics where I have the authority to be of value to people, as opposed to, you know, purely the value of our guests, who I think are far more impressive than me, which is why doing everything so far for us, interview based and guest based is what we've done. But I kind of look to Tim as the one of the guiding lights of how to do and build an effective podcast. And then another big name one is what Gary Vaynerchuk, does really with all of his media, but especially what he does with his podcasts, where a lot of them are done as video recorded interviews. So he'll set up a camera across the table and they'll do it as video and audio. But more and more, they're also doing audio. And it's just what he taught me, and is one of the things that I try to do with ours, is he taught me to look outside the bubble and to not just talk to people within our industry, but to look outside our industry to see what we can learn from others that we can then apply to what we do. So in the intro, you mentioned I've interviewed comedians and I've interviewed astrophysicists, and that was really all by design. You know, the main focus of our podcast is how to engage an audience. And when you think of a comedian who has to get up on stage and make people laugh on command for 7 minutes, is a pretty daunting thing to have to do, but you have to know how to control and engage an audience. So, and we've tried to look far and wide different disciplines that we can learn from.
I really like how you structured your podcast. What evolution have you gone through? What key learnings have you applied over the 10 episodes that you've done this year?
I like to think I've gotten better. When I go back and listen to the first few, I personally cringe. I know all of the things that I didn't know then that I know now. We try to make them, probably sounds silly, but we try to make them very listenable. What we started doing after the first few episodes when we released them is we started putting a teaser at the front, where we take a more compelling clip and put that right at the front before any intro or any music or anything, because that's like the subject line of an email. That's the hook that's hopefully going to get people to want to listen. And then, we try to keep the intro really brief and just get right into the meat of the discussion. And, we've been playing with different lengths as well. I mentioned, we talked about Tim Ferriss before, and his interviews will often run 90 minutes, 2 hours. I've never done anything anywhere near that. We started out a little bit longer at about 45, 50 minutes. And I think we had trouble keeping listeners that long. So we started shortening them down. And now I shoot for around 30 minutes. Some of them I deliberately structure closer to 20 minutes. So those are really the things I've learned, is how to structure them, how to get people hooked early, and then how to give them just the right amount of time where they'll want to listen to the whole thing and we won't lose their attention.
It's really tricky trying to find this balance. I think one of the things I've noticed is if you go to a professionally structured piece of content like Serial, for example, they're very good in that they always feel the same lengthwise, structure, content wise, etc. But then if you look at like a Gary V or Gary Vaynerchuk structure, sometimes, to your point, he's pulling just a highlight reel from the last 2 months worth of content. Other times it could be a keynote, and then other times it could be just a staff meeting that might last only 10 minutes, right? So you have this massive variability. I have found that one of my biggest frustration points is that I cannot track when listener drop-off occurs, right? So I tell you what, man, if this whole market research thing doesn't work out, somebody's got to solve the problem of content management on podcasts so that we can just get that, somehow close the loop on things like new listeners, attrition, repeat, etc.
Yeah, we've had that exact same conversation here, and it's the one thing that makes us pull our hair out is we know how many, quote, downloads we get, but we have no way to know how much people are listening. And, in our world of research, especially the work that we do where we're tracking feedback to TV pilots and advertisements and radio content second by second, that's the world I live in. I want to know if there's a trend of where I'm losing people in a podcast, and is there something about the way I've structured it that forces people to tune out, or that's keeping them to the end, or they're bouncing where they're listening to the first 30 seconds and then they're out. So if there's something out there that I'm not aware of, I'd love to know what it is. But I agree with you. That's a big thing that we're missing as well.
And this is probably boring the rest of the audience, but a little bit more inside baseball. I was meeting recently with the senior director of audience insights at NPR, and he oversees the podcast data as well. And so I started, and you know that they have their own app and player, so they can track all the things that you and I wish we could track. So I was talking to him about trying to get a sense of where the dropout, you know what I mean? And then wondering if he could, they had found a surrogate for things like new listeners, and all the data research that they had done, trying to extrapolate on, you know, their own app to the broader, you know, iTunes, iHeartRadio, whatever, Google Play, they said it just falls apart. So there just isn't currently a solution that they've found. And I think they probably got the pockets for it. Right. And, to figure it out, tips, you know, that can track that piece. But somebody's going to be a billionaire when they can solve that problem.
But that's the next startup idea then.
Somebody else.
If someone else doesn't do it and we get frustrated enough, we just might do it ourselves,
there,
I guess.
There you go. It's awesome. So, you know, I think it was December 3rd you started of 2018. Talk to me about the role of personal brand and how that's helped or maybe even gotten in the way of your business.
You know, for us, we haven't focused too tremendously on personal brands in either division of our company, Dialsmith or Engages. We really try to make sure that it's the companies that shine through and that we don't tie the businesses to any one person or any couple of people. So I do host the podcast, and I'm doing more speaking now, as well as my business partner, who heads up the research side of our business, more on the consulting side, and he's an excellent speaker as well. But we really try to focus more on the brand of the business, and managing two different brands is tricky. That's been another bit of a challenge for the last year. We're having fun doing it, but definitely some sticky moments in how to do that effectively. So really what I want to do is I want to establish trust. I want people to know that when they hear my name, that they can rely on what they're going to hear is going to be valuable to them. I'm obsessed with feeling like I'm delivering value and not wasting people's time. That I think that's the greatest disservice, is if somebody was nice enough to give me a little bit of their time and listen to either what I have to say or what I bring to them through a podcast or something, and then they feel like it wasn't worth their time. That's just tragic. So, really it's trust and reliability that's most important to me from just a personal reputation standpoint. But we focus a lot more on the company brands than we do on any individuals.
You think there's going to be four podcasts at least spawned this year in the market research industry, which is a pretty small industry in general. Do you think there's going to be a more podcasts that come up going into 2019 and looking forward to 20?
My gut tells me there probably will be. The beauty of podcasting is there's a low barrier to entry, even if you want to make sure that you do it well. A good quality microphone is not that expensive, and using online tools like you and I both do to record that are anywhere from free to a few bucks, it really comes down to, do you have an editorial point of view, and can you drive a discussion in a way that's going to make people interested to listen? But the barrier to entry is very low. You don't have to be setting up a video rig with a lot of lights. You don't have to be uncomfortable being in front of a video camera. You don't have to do anything on the street, like man on the street kind of stuff. So, yeah, I do think we're going to see more and more of it. The biggest trick really is diligence. You know, getting started, doing a couple of episodes, that's the easy part. Then you realize that if you really want to build an audience, you have to be consistent. You have to put out content regularly, and it has to measure up. It has to be valuable enough. So, you know, we're on a cadence right now where we put out an episode every 2 weeks. We have enough content we could do weekly. We just want to give ourselves enough time to let each episode breathe out in the market and be able to promote it enough so that we don't step on one episode after another. So, Our consistency right now is we're on a every 2 week cadence, and we'll see if going into 2019 if we decide to alter that at all. I'm not sure. How often do you guys put out episodes?
My focus this year was figuring out how the hell to podcast. So the best way for me to do that was just create as many episodes as I could. So that was the whole meta for 2018. And kind of like your journey, when I started out, it was catastrophic. And it fortunately, you know, you learn through failure and you learn through success as well. And we've gotten better and better. And so going into, we're moving from a twice weekly to every 2 week structure in 2019. My gut is telling we're going to do different like on-site, at show, and this is something you've done as well, very effectively, I might add, on-site interviews, you know, that sort of thing. I don't know. It's interesting because it takes a lot of time. That's the big problem, right? It isn't the hardware or the software investment. It's the focus investment. And so that's the piece that I think companies need to think about when they're considering the trade-off of should I do it, should I not? It's very much like a trade show, you know, that the trade show itself takes time, but the prep and the trade show creative, et cetera. And then the post is also, you've got to be committed to all three aspects of it, not just having salespeople show up and stay at a nice place. So that's for us, the big piece of learning is that, at least we think, what the audience wants is deeper, more context, deeper conversations, more context, more, a few more segments. So we're going to move into next year. We'll have two different additional segments. One's going to be HR tips and tricks for increasing overall engagement or managing up or whatever. And then we're also going to have some technology and research tips and tricks and trends segments. So we're, you know, breaking it up a little bit, probably going to a longer show format. Right now we're about 20 to 30 minutes, and I think we'll probably be around 35-ish minutes with the additional segments, and then adding a couple more voices in there. I think could be interesting too. What do you think about the role of webinars and podcasts? Do you think there's some tension that's developing there?
I haven't seen tension. I find webinars tend to be more informative and instructive, and podcasts tend to be more informational and conversational. So we still do both, but we have a pretty natural delineation between when we want to educate versus when we want to inform. And that's where we tend to lean more toward webinars when we want to educate. Clearly, if you want to demonstrate something, drive an important point home. And then for podcasts, we come up with our content calendar for what we think will be interesting or things that will group well together. And we try to be informative, but also make sure that there are some key takeaways. My hope is that after every episode, someone can go to work tomorrow and apply something that they got directly out of that episode. And then over time, I hope it continues to unfold for them and they can continue to apply things as time goes by.
So really quick, put you on the spot. What is one of the favorite things that you've taken away from your podcast?
For me personally, it's made me better at conversations. It's funny because as much as I've been in sales my whole career, I'm still pretty introverted. I'm the person when I go to a conference, I'm not comfortable walking up to a group of people and just inserting myself and starting to talk. Even though sales is my background, that's just not the way I operate. So it's made me more comfortable having conversations on the fly, because while I do script out the interviews a little bit with topics I want to cover, I try to let the conversations flow organically. And that's, for me, that's spilled over beyond the podcast just into how I communicate with people in general.
All right. Well, shifting gears, a few of our guests, we've done this game and I'm really starting to like it. This isn't going to be like a mainstay, but it'll probably close out 2018 and then we'll revisit it here in a couple of years. But I originally started it with with one of our guests, Stacy Walker, head of insights at Adobe. And it's just sort of caught on, I guess, since there. So here we go. Mm-hmm. If you are a VC who is investing in future technologies for market research. Let's say that you have 10 David bucks. So it's like the new virtual coin, right? Everybody's using it. It's very popular. Right. So you have 8 different options on where you can invest. You can distribute your 10 David bucks however you want across these options. The first one is virtual reality. Second one is augmented reality. Then we have qualitative at scale, and that can be any sort of qualitative at scale, video, NLP, whatever. Voice. Mm-hmm. So thinking about like Alexa, Google Home. Yep. Big data, traditional trackers, blockchain, and I'm going to call it human intelligence or consulting. How would you distribute your 10 David bucks? Where maximum ROI in 5 years?
Oh, that is all right. That's an interesting game to play. Let's see. The ones that jump out at me the most, we can boil it down a little bit more from there. VR, certainly. I think it's a little bit slower to ramp up than maybe some people thought it would, but it's a huge culture shift for people to have to consume content, at least currently inside of goggles. But the potential there is off the charts. And if we're speaking especially about market research, specifically, there are things you can do in VR that would have been impossible or incredibly expensive to do otherwise. So we definitely put some there. I think AR has tremendous possibilities as well when you can put people in these environments or put things in front of people that would, again, be virtually impossible to do otherwise. So VR, AR, I would absolutely invest in. I think voice is huge. Speaking specifically about market research, maybe not as much about just in the industry in general as you look at what Alexa and Google Home are doing. So specifically for market research, I might not put too much in voice, but I do think in general, voice is huge. Qual at scale, especially since you mentioned video, absolutely without a doubt. To be able to, especially you look at what the likes of Vox Pop Me and others are doing, I think that's a big one. So VR, AR, qual at scale, and then I would put the rest into number 8, that human intelligence. I just don't think that we can afford to take the human element out of everything that we need to do. Machines are great at telling you what people think. They're not so great at telling you why. And you didn't have AI on your list. AI probably belongs in this conversation as well. And that will certainly begin to help us automatically understand the why. But I don't think you can beat the human intelligence when it comes to converting what into why. And ultimately, why is what matters.
Yeah. My very first brand interview was with Roher Verhulst at LinkedIn, and he had this great quote that I've referenced a lot. Research has to be about the so what and now what, right? So it's really kind of tailoring it back to this concept of ROI and then contextualizing the data or the insights so that the executive knows what in the heck it means for, you know, relative to the decision.
Yeah, absolutely. That in the end, that's all that matters. And that's where human intelligence always comes into play for me.
So I'm a big believer in voice having a material impact on our industry, especially as it impacts our customers. I think my thesis is that, and I'm, you know, like you, I think we're similar in age. We remember the pre-internet days, right? My thesis is that if you can remember the 90s, where, you know, this internet was this sort of thing, you didn't really have didn't know what to do with it. And then it evolved to be obviously one of the backbones, actually probably the backbone of is the backbone of information today. It's actually replaced the father-child relationship in many ways to find out, you know, how to get something done. And then you think about the iPod and then later the iPhone, you know, the initial use case for the iPhone was music and you could do talking stuff, right? I mean, that was kind of the initial phases in 2006 and 7. The voice right now is functioning a lot in the same sort of narrative. And my hunch is that voice, because it is passive in the way that we interact with it, and we can do other stuff like drive or work out at the gym, as you said, you know, it starts getting really interesting because the opportunity for us as researchers to intercept and get feedback, whether it's post utilization of a skill or app, gets really powerful, right? Because you can get that feedback in real time, and along with it comes things like sentiment, obviously natural language processing, etc. But I haven't seen market research, and I know, again, this is early days. I just think that once it hits, it's going to be at scale quick and too late for brands to start paying attention or adjusting their strategies around it, right?
Yeah, well, it's a lot like what's happened with video. I think video has really started to take root, especially with regards to gathering feedback. And, you know, voice is actually trailing a bit because with video, you can see people's expressions and you can read their faces and learn so much more than just voice. But like we were talking about with podcasts earlier, voice is so much more ubiquitous and you can do it anywhere and you don't worry about what do you look like or where am I or what's around me. So I think it's interesting to see what'll be to come.
Yeah, for sure. Because voice has this, to your point, has this uniqueness of getting as close as you can before we can, you know, do mind reading to the human, you know, giving feedback to the experience, right? Because it is, mm-hmm. again, it's passive. You can keep both hands on your shopping cart while you're pushing, right, your kids and looking for groceries at Walmart, and then still give feedback. There's not another way to be able to garner that feedback other than voice. And yeah, I mean, who knows how the big boys are going to, you know, I know that Nielsen has recently started adding it into their reports, their quarterly reports, and there's a few other companies that are rattling sabers about it. But it'll be interesting to see how 2019 shakes out and if voice becomes a centerpiece for either new tech companies that evolve or existing large companies that create units around it or product solutions around it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Talk to us. I am curious about the two brand strategy, Engages and Dialsmith. Do you guys mm-hmm. think that is there a rationale to try and combine those, or is it Google and Yahoo? Or is it Google and YouTube is what I meant. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, you know, we serve, in some cases we serve two different kinds of clients, and in other cases we overlap. So, you know, Dialsmith was the original business, and we're often hired by other research firms or large divisions, research divisions within large companies. And then Engages being more of a consultancy, we're not generally competing against Dialsmith clients. We were pretty deliberate about not wanting to do that. And because Engages is so kind of laser focused on communications, messaging, storytelling, we don't find that we compete very often, which is important to us, but we do want the market to know that Dialsmith does what it does with regards to dial testing tools in person, online, mobile. And then Engages is all about engaging audiences with content and messages and stories. So we deliberately kept the brands pretty separate so far in the market. And while we do cross-pollinate a little bit, and we don't make any secrets about it, I'm talking about it openly right now, we just find that through our marketing activities, it's cleaner to keep the two separate because we do tend to serve different areas of the market.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I think that the clarity around brand creates this opportunity to punch through on what the products are, as opposed to potentially get enveloped in a larger brand, creating some confusion around what the product or solutions are that you're bringing to market and how customers relate to you.
Yeah, it can get really muddy. I mean, I just imagine if we tried to set up a combined Dialsmith Engages website, I think the task would be would drive me crazy. Certainly Dialsmith could be thought of as a technology division of Engages as a consultancy, but they're both really niche and, you know, on the smaller side, generally speaking. So having them each stand alone on their own two feet with their own brands and their own messaging seems to be the right strategy for now. And you know, we'll see what the future holds.
So David, tell us a little bit about what it is that your company is offering now and what's finding purchase in the marketplace.
What we're offering now is we've definitely capitalized on the storytelling trend, and especially storytelling related to market research, whether it's telling stories with data or through data visualization, or using narrative as a way to communicate as opposed to just bullet points or taking people through some kind of an outline or an overview. So a lot of what we're building through Engages are these frameworks that can be used to take all kinds of communications and put those into more of a storytelling type of narrative so that you can take people on a journey. You can pull those emotional levers when necessary in order to communicate a story and in order to try to influence, you know, and move a market in one direction or another. So at least on the Engages side of our business, that's been our big focus for this year. And I think a lot of that'll continue going into next year as well.
My guest today has been David Paul, CEO of Engages and Dialsmith. David, thanks very much for joining me today on the Happy Market Research Podcast.
Jamin, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you, everyone who's been tuning in. As always, you can subscribe on Apple, actually on the platform of your choice. So I particularly listen to iTunes reviews, love them, share them, take the time. It is how we spread the word about and get fantastic guests like David Paul. Thanks very much and have a great rest of your day.
Hi, this is David Paul, and you're listening to the Happy Market Research Podcast.